Are you searching for an education that forms not just the mind, but the soul? At Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, we believe learning should be more than just getting a degree. It should be about discovering truth, beauty, and virtue. Located in the beautiful and historic Merrimack Valley, Thomas More College is a Catholic liberal arts college dedicated to the great books and the pursuit of wisdom. But here students don't just study philosophy, theology, literature, history and classical languages. They engage in lively discussions in small, close-knit classes, guided by devoted professors. And they don't just learn about faith, they live it. Through a vibrant Catholic community, daily mass, and a curriculum rooted in the teachings of the Church. Every student at Thomas More College also spends a full semester in Rome, at no extra cost beyond tuition. In the heart of Christendom, they walk the same streets as saints and scholars, study in the shadow of St. Peter's Basilica, and experience Catholic culture in a way that no textbook ever could. If you, or someone you know, is looking for an education that challenges the intellect and nourishes the soul, visit thomasmorecollege.edu to learn more. Thomas More College. Experience more. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashington. Professor Nigel Bigger is a very well-known Anglican clergyman and a prominent academic. He was Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at the University of Oxford from 2007 to 2022. And his rise to public prominence began partly in response to a five-year project he began, which was entitled Ethics and Empire. The intention was to scrutinise critiques against the historical facts of colonialism and the British Empire. It was always Nigel Bigger's position that it was the duty of a historian, a moral theologian, to gather the facts and to look at and assess both sides of the coin. But the difficulty is that this area directly confronts the climate of intellectual and cultural reconfiguration, both in terms of history and academia, which is now set determinedly in terms of looking at power relations interpreted along the lines of racial difference. It wasn't long before Professor Bigger faced the forces of cancellation. Bloomsbury originally offered to take his book Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning, which examines the morality of colonialism, but then decided it wasn't going to publish it, suggesting that public feeling on the subject does not currently support the publication of this book. This outrageous act of cancellation was remedied, fortunately, by HarperCollins, who took it on and have published it so that we can all make up our own minds about the values of the arguments he presents. In recent days, Professor Bigger has come to prominence again, partly through the medium of a report published by Policy Exchange, critiquing the Church of England's determination to dip into its historic investment funds and pay slavery reparations. He joins me now.
I feel I know you very well, though we haven't actually met, but because you've been such an important figure on the radar as you have stood against the invasion of the Goths, the Visigoths, the Handels, the Huns and the Vandals in this new moment of the defeat of civilization, and repudiated them with fact and wisdom and an antidote to the toxicity of mind that also lies behind the new propaganda we've been getting. And so what I hope we might do is to talk first of all about a more balanced view of what colonialism was, maybe is, historically, and then look at the two particular challenges which are based essentially on the notion that it's irredeemably evil and needs to be made up for by money, gifts of money, both by the Labour government and also by the Church of England and the commissioners. So can I ask you, first of all, I know you've done this so many times, and thank you for being so patient, but to those who haven't heard you before, offer a more reasonable tableau of the vices and virtues of the historic phenomenon of colonialism.
Gavin, first of all, let me say thanks a lot for having me on. I'm glad to meet you not in the flesh, but in the virtual flesh. Yes. The first time. I've known your name for a long time. I'm glad you think that I've been a voice of reason. Not everyone thinks that, of course. But I'm also glad to have a chance to talk again about the truth, the whole truth about Britain's colonial record, because it's politically really important, and some really bad mistakes are being made because of a distorted understanding of the past. So, So whenever I talk about these things, the first thing I urge is we have to put Britain's 400-year career as a colonial imperial power into context. And the context is, for most of history, most people have lived under empires. Empire is a very was a very common form of political organization up until the end of the First World War. And secondly, the phenomenon of peoples migrating. So we all, part of the British Empire involved hundreds of thousands of Britons migrating across the Atlantic and eventually migrating to the likes of Australia and New Zealand. But that phenomenon is worldwide and ancient. In the 1600s, the Iroquois expanded northward from the Great Lakes in North America, displacing the Huron. In the 1700s, the Comanche expanded westward, overwhelmed the Apache in the southwest of what's the United States now. In the 1800s and 1820s, the Zulu expanded westwards. In 1835, the Maori landed in the Chatham Islands. So we need to put European movement and colonization and imperial expansion into a wider context where European and British empire is nothing exceptional.
Can I ask you to throw in a footnote, without wanting to disturb the trajectory of your thought, but just because it was so interesting, listening to you talk to John Anderson and say, well, the Maori arrived in the Chatham Islands, and the Aborigines, cross though they might have been with the Caucasian invaders and everything they brought, I remember you saying they were extremely lucky the Maori didn't get there first, because the British came with some notion of being willing to share the concept of subject and civic responsibilities and the protection. But the Maori would have accorded them nothing like that.
Well, the contrast I make is between the Iroquois and Maori on one hand and the British in the other. So I mentioned the Iroquois expanding northward and overwhelming the Huron in the 1640s. The Iroquois had a quaint form of dealing with the vanquished. They adopted the women and children of the vanquished race, and the men they ate. The Maori, when they landed on the Chatham Islands in 1835, they slaughtered 10% of the population and enslaved the rest. By stark contrast, when Admiral Arthur Phillip and the First Fleet arrived in Sydney Cove in 1788, and in the years following, they sought to make friends with local Aboriginal people. Aboriginal people, of course, were suspicious of these strange people. On the other hand, as the settlement established itself, Sydney began to provide much more reliable supplies of food for Aboriginal people who were hunter-gatherers and were not accustomed to having reliable sources of food. And Arthur Phillip had his settlers and his convicts and his seamen share the fish they caught with the Aboriginals. When disease broke out, he gave the Aboriginals medical treatment. At one point, he was speared by an Aboriginal and he refused to retaliate. And he had Aboriginals walk into his home at will and to sit down and eat with them. Now, the story of the encounter between white men and Aboriginal Australia was not all happy. There was a lot of violence subsequently. But I just make that point to contrast the beginnings of settlement in Australia with the Maori and the Iroquois example, just to put things in context again.
Can I ask you a question again? Confident that your trajectory of thought is inviolable and I'm not putting you off it. Because it's very interesting that the anti-colonialists have no great problem with power. It's not the power of colonialism that they object to, because they themselves philosophically deal in power in the sense that cultural Marxism sees the human beings through the prism of power, but it wants to reverse it. Would it be fair to say that since they agree on the centrality of power as the measure of human relations, that it's essentially a form of racist, anti-white restitution? That in other words, they're not objecting to the use of power because they are perfectly willing to accept it as a currency and redistribute it. In which case, what are they objecting to? And it seems to me that the only thing they can be objecting to is either technological competence, which is what the whites came with, or whiteness itself, in which case it becomes a racist anti-white movement. Is that too stark?
Well, that's a very good point, Gavin. I mean, I want to say, much to the consternation of liberal folk and often many Christians, that power is a fact of life, folks. And I'm afraid unequal power is a fact of life. And the only question really is whether you use your superior power well or badly. But yes, so the focus on the deliberately myopic focus on the sins of white people, of British people, slavery, etc., is designed to make it appear as if it's only white people who have ever abused power, which is complete right. historical nonsense.
And that's what I mean by saying it's a form of racist anti-white philosophy.
I agree. And then of course, the fact that the British, after 1807, used their imperial power, not least the Royal Navy, in the humanitarian cause of suppressing slavery from Brazil to New Zealand, that, of course, is completely ignored by the anti-colonialists.
Extraordinary.
It completely messes up their story.
Yes, that's right. Yes, because it is. I mean, I forget what proportion of GDP the British state dedicated to saving other people from slavery, but it was a relatively enormous sum.
Well, a couple of American political scientists estimated that in the 60 years from 1807 to 1868, the British spent 1.8% of national income every year for 60 years. Now, I'm not quite sure how national income relates to GDP, but if it is somewhat comparable, then right now we're spending 0.5% on international development,
right.
0.5% to 1.8%. So this commitment, this imperial commitment, this use of imperial power for humanitarian purposes was not inexpensive. So shall I pick up my...
Yes, please do. I'm sorry to have to almost derailed you, but I thought those two passing points might be helpful as you continue.
Feel free. So I can tell the story at shorter, greater length, Gavin. So let me try and be succinct, and then you can get me to expand if you want. So first of all, let's put things in context. Secondly, let's be sensible here. Any 600-year-old state or political organization, starting in 1550 up until about 1960, any such state is going to include a lot of bad stuff, because you know we Christians, we take it for granted that you know human beings are both limited in knowledge and power, so they make awful mistakes. We make awful mistakes, and also we are subject to moral corruption and all sorts of vices. So we do bad stuff. We do bad things, so that's a fact of the human condition. So the fact the British Empire contained bad stuff, and it did, should not surprise us. Although it does seem to surprise a lot of contemporary progressive people who imagine that only they themselves are saints. So that's the second thing I say. Then third, I'd say in addition to the bad stuff, in addition to 150 years of slavery, in addition to some racist prejudice, in addition to unjustified use of violence, in addition to not allowing native peoples to enter the highest echelons of government when perhaps they should have been allowed to, and we can go on. So that's the bad stuff. But the good stuff is this. In the late 1700s, the British people, not just the elite, but people, became increasingly persuaded that for one person to own another person as their disposable property as a slave was morally abhorrent. And that's what led to the abolition of the slave trade and then slavery in 1833. And the British were among the first peoples in the history of the world to do this. The context again is slavery was a universal institution, and well into the 19th century, Arabs are establishing slave plantations in what's now West Africa and East Africa after the British have abolished it on their territory. So there was this growth of a kind of moral revolution, mainly Christian, somewhat Enlightenment, depending upon your social class. And then that expands in the 1830s to a general concern about the plight of Aboriginal peoples. Christians and humanitarians in London became aware of how Aboriginal folk in Australia were suffering, not least from the spread of disease inadvertently. And so the concern for slaves then expands into a concern for native peoples generally. And then you also have the introduction of liberal institutions. You have a free press. Colonial government was not democratic until in India in the 1930s. But there was a free press in India and Hong Kong and South Africa. In the 1890s, Cecil Rhodes helped to fund a Black African newspaper. And often the free press was very free in its criticism of colonial government, in a way that the press in China, Russia, Iran, North Korea to this day is not free. Mm-hmm. And then you've got also the introduction of an independent judiciary. And during the Mau Mau emergency in Kenya in the 1950s and 60s, the judiciary was often fiercely critical of the behavior of the authorities, in the way in which courts in China, Russia, North Korea, Iran to this day cannot be. Penultimately, I say, in addition, from the 1820s onwards, gathering speed in the early 1900s, the idea that the empire has to eventually relax into a voluntary association of independent states begins to become ascendant. So the phrase, the British Commonwealth of Nations, is invented by Jan Smuts in 1917. By 1930, Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand are virtually independent. 1919 onwards, India is on the same track. Before its ending, at least in principle and to some extent in practice, the empire had begun to morph into a voluntary association. And then my final point is this. Between 1939 and 1945, the British Empire committed itself to fight Nazi Germany and Japanese imperialism, which even Indians who wanted the British out of India recognized was altogether worse than anything, any of their irritations with the British. And between May 1940 and June 41, May 1940 when France fell and June 41 when the Soviets were invaded by Germany, the British Empire offered Nazi Germany the only military resistance, with the sole exception of Greece. And if you find yourself driving in Sicily, southwest of Mount Etna, from Regalbuto to Agira, at a certain point you'll notice a cemetery on your left-hand side. You get out, walk among the graves, and find yourself surrounded by young Canadians. And if you walk long enough, you'll come to a headstone devoted to H.R. Anderson, aged 28, killed on the 18th of July, 1943. And I noticed this headstone I like visiting military cemeteries, Gavin, but I noticed this because it had a very unusual epitaph. It read, "Anti-fascist fighter." And Anderson was a volunteer. He didn't have to go. He volunteered, came from Canada, died in Sicily, and who called him? The British Empire. So all I want to say to folk is, yes, the Empire contained bad stuff. Give me a long-standing state that hasn't. But it also chalked up some extraordinary humanitarian and liberal achievements. The real irony here is, Gavin, that the things about the British Empire I like are liberal and progressive.
Yes, yes. So you're an advocate for the liberal and progressive view. And there are a couple of thoughts that occur to me. And one is that it's probably worth, since our listeners are going to be theologically astute people, it's probably worth putting on record that part of the difficulty with the progressive analysis is, as you hinted in passing, that there is a sense that human beings are without original sin and therefore are, at least in the terms of Rousseau, perfectible, if only by yep. education or what the state can bestow upon them. And so in Christian terms, the progressive position seems to me to depend upon a completely unreasonable and unrealistic view of human nature, because, as you quite rightly said, if you're a Christian and you expect to see a mixed economy of virtue in the way in which people manage their affairs, both in and out of empires, in and out of countries, irrespective of the warm or cold currents of morality that they swim in, that's the human condition. But the waters are partly muddied philosophically by this utopian notion that human beings, if there's anything wrong, it can't be wrong with people. There's a kind of hubris, I suppose, about the anthropocentrism of the
progressive. Yes.
And therefore, if there's nothing wrong with the people, well, there must be their system. But we reverse that, I think.
Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting topic. I mean, there are different facets to it. One facet is a tendency of progressive anti-colonialists to look at the past with horror and to judge the past according to human rights standards of now, without really taking into account just how different the circumstances of the past really were. How, you know, we enjoy unprecedented security and health and wealth in Britain and in the West today, even today. In the past, life was nasty, short and brutish. There was lots of insecurity, and where there's insecurity, you have recourse to violence much more readily. But there's a strange, a complete lack of historical imagination on the part of some of these people, and therefore a lack of human sympathy for human beings caught in circumstances much more constrained and menacing than our own. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and this goes back to your point about kind of reverse racism. If you read some historians, as I have done on these matters, you do come across the phenomenon of what I call ethical schizophrenia. So everything that indigenous peoples do, even the nasty stuff is treated with the balm of indulgence. But everything white people do, everything the British do, is treated with the acid of cynicism. So it's as if, and there is an idealization. You know, the indigenous peoples are noble savages. They if it weren't for the whites, they'd be living in Eden. But the whites are diabolical. It's a really stark Manichaean, very un-Augustinian view of the world.
I'm always aware that I want to explore what racism actually means, because I think you're describing racism. It's the anti-white racism I began with. And I'm slightly hesitant to go in certain places because they're really they're minefields. But can I ask you, as both a theologian and a historian, about the relationship of Christianity with slavery? So let me just throw in a few markers, if I can, and ask you to respond to them. One of the things that's often put to the church by progressives is, well, Christianity is quite clearly in favour of slavery. It must be an appalling measure, because we don't find St. Paul agitating against the institution. And nowhere in the Bible do we find a mandate for human freedom explicitly, implicitly, obviously. But my understanding of slavery is made more complex by the fact that when I look at, for example, aspects of certain Roman slavery, slavery appears to be another version of welfare state to some extent. Take away the very nasty notion of a person owning another, if one can even, but let's say one can, then one of the reasons why you wouldn't have wanted all slaves to be set free was that there were certain contexts of people where their slavery provided them with security, identity, the opportunity of growing through slavery into becoming a full citizen of the state, with a pathway of self-betterment that at least was a pathway, even if it wasn't automatic. This is not intended for a second to be an apologia for slavery, only to look at the fact that it consists in a complex tableau. But when I think, for example, of Soviet Russia and the Soviet Union between 1917 and 1989, I'm at a loss to understand how the citizens weren't slaves of the state. In other words, the progressive left looks at certain aspects of slavery, particularly, I think, and wrongly, through the eye of the American Civil War and the disastrous relations between the races in America. But this is such a narrow, a peculiar view when we have, as I suggest, at the very benign end, perhaps a degree of patronage in the better parts of Romanism, and a degree of utter vice and horror in the Marxist state solution, which seems to me to be as clear an expression of slavery as you could ever have in terms of the state owning people and disposing of them. Could you formulate that in a slightly more sophisticated way, but particularly in the context of what people claim is Christianity's checkered history of its relations with the concept of slavery?
Very good. The first thing I want to say is that slavery can mean many things and has meant many things historically. Slavery, in its kind of pure form, is the ownership of another human being who has no rights whatsoever. So your control is absolute. And even if a slave owner happens to be humane and charitable in some way, you don't, given what Christians believe about the propensity of human beings to be corrupt and abusive, you just don't want to give any human being that kind of absolute power over someone else. So let me be clear. If slavery means the absolute control of one human being by another, it's wrong. That shouldn't be the case. That said, as you alluded, in history, slavery has taken all sorts of different forms. And we need, you know, when we think about these things, we need to get our mind around the fact that slavery was so universal. Mm. If you go to the Museum of the History of the State of North Carolina in Raleigh, as I did 2 years ago, among other things, you will discover that on the eve of the American Civil War in 1860, in the state of North Carolina, there were 30,000 freed slaves, some of whom kept black slaves of their own.
Yeah.
So common was the practice. So we just need to, that may be very hard for us to understand, but it is a fact, and we need to understand why it was so common. Okay. On to Christianity. So, what we do have in the New Testament is, of course, St. Paul's letter to Philemon, the very short letter. And this concerns a case of a runaway slave, Onesimus, who's come to Paul, and Paul is sending Onesimus back to his master. And so, in a sense, Paul pays the institution of slavery respect by returning the slave to his, according to Roman law, rightful owner. But in the letter to Philemon, the slave master, Paul says, I'm sending you back Onesimus, whom I expect you to receive, quote, as a beloved brother. And the way I interpret that is to say, you know, with much of Christianity, at least in the New Testament, is not in the business of a kind of frontal assault on unjust social institutions. But this is a subtle internal assault, because when slave owners treat slaves as beloved brothers, what exactly remains of slavery? So this is the mustard seed infecting and growing, which is a model that our Lord sanctified. So it's not true to say that the New Testament is simply accepting of slavery. There's a kind of subtle criticism there. Now, I don't know about the history of slavery in the Christian West. I do know that slavery lost any legal backing in medieval France and England. So at a certain point, I don't know exactly when, 13th century maybe, slavery lost any legal status. So someone who was trying to enslave someone else could not appeal to the law to support them. If progressives say that Christianity's record is poor on this, the fact of the matter is it was in the late 1700s, starting with the Quakers, certainly in New England, maybe in England too, spreading to Methodists and Evangelicals. The movement to abolish slavery was a popular movement, and it was predominantly Christian. I mean, there were Enlightenment influences as well, but they would influence social class. But the popular movement to abolish slavery was Christian, and I have read when it came to the vote to abolish the slave trade in Parliament in 1807, the Anglican bishops played a good hand. I mean, they voted to abolish it. So it's not true to say that the church's record is one of relentless approval of slavery. And the other general point, Gavin, is this. There is such a thing as the growth of moral awareness. And there are things of which we are acutely aware now that people in the past were not acutely aware of, but we're acutely aware of them because of the legacy of what others have given us. And there, you know, it is absolutely certain there are things of which we are, to which we are morally numb right now, that future generations will damn us for.
But
if they do, it's only because they are the beneficiaries of a process of moral enlightenment. So final point, the other feature of progressive judgment in these matters is the really ugly self-righteousness and the lack of any sense that we are morally sensitive only because we are lucky enough to have learned from what was given us.
I think this is very interesting, because one of the things it does is to suggest that the two philosophical worlds that don't understand each other at all, and that is that, if you like, the political utopian view is that no change, any situation in which the structures of injustice aren't changed must be an immoral one. But that isn't the Christian worldview at all. The Christian worldview, I was trying to think of what concept I might best use. Transformation of the heart is one, but I rather liked your phrase better. A moral sensitivity, a moral enlightenment. So what Christianity does is, given the passing stages of different societies, different contexts, different structures, different expectations, it always does something consistent and universal, which is the illumination of the human heart, the introduction of a degree of a capacity for personal moral progress. Now, my understanding as someone who's not been drawn ever to the utopian as the left is, that this is a far more effective way of achieving radical outcomes politically, because if you can increase the number of people who are morally aware, morally responsible, morally aspirational, then that's one of the great ways in which political leverage can be expressed. And it's less likely to put all your eggs into the basket of one particular form of revolution, because the problem with political revolution is that they don't have much of a lifespan, and the deficit, what's not quite the right word I'm looking for, but the flaw in the progressive utopian strategy is that very few structures that aim to improve the justice of a society last very long at all. Whereas the Christian church can say, well, we've been busy trying to provide moral enlightenment for cultures, and we can, if you like, trace almost like a warm current the way in which this develops a degree of humanitarian awareness, and which inevitably has a political expression, because we can't build a hermetic seal between the way in which we look at other human beings and the way in which we vote or accept society. But it seems to me that very little is made of this capacity and this ambition within Christianity for a program of moral change, because if it's not, the people we're dealing with are so metaphysically and I suppose almost psychologically blinkered that this isn't a currency of improvement that they either see or recognize. It's either transformation of of political structures or yep. It's nothing. It's immoral.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, this. I guess as a political conservative, I might say this, although in a sense I'm a political conservative because I do think it's true. I mean, the model of change in the Gospels, and I think even in the Epistles of Paul, is organic.
Right.
So, you know, Jesus' metaphors for the spread of the kingdom, mustard seed, yeast, St. Paul, when masters treat slaves as brothers, it's from the inside. It's organic. It's social. It's not the structure. The reform of structures comes later, and so you know when I used to teach ethics, Gavin, and we're talking, I gave an example. St. Paul on the equality of the sexes. Now, you can find in the letters of St. Paul, I think, conflicting ideas, sometimes going in the direction of sexual equality, others affirming a kind of traditional Roman patriarchal hierarchy. And I interpret St. Paul as, you know, St. Paul's thought, you know, St. Paul was a human being, inspired maybe, but a human being. And as with all human beings, our thought is en route, often we have different thoughts in our heads that don't quite cohere, but they're kind of moving in a certain direction. So even in the pages of the New Testament, you can see the development of thought, and some of the germs of ideas in the New Testament have taken centuries to work their way out, and they're still working their way out.
But I think St. Paul is a very good example of exactly what you've been describing, because what he deals with between husbands and wives and men and women is precisely this softening of the heart, this self-giving, interdependent mutuality, which then works from the inside outwards. So he's not interested in overthrowing patriarchy, because how would he do that anyway? And you know, to what end would Christians overthrow patriarchy and replace it with what? I mean, that there is no programmatic form of revolution with a political edge in St. Paul, but he does do exactly what you described, which is set off an organic process of moral enlightenment in terms of the way human beings understand their duties, their compassionate duties to one another in the context in which they find themselves, which will later be changed by that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let me take you to the church commissioners, if I can. they may be more opaque than the theology of St. Paul. I don't mean to be rude, but when I first heard that the former Archbishop of Canterbury was leading the charge to unlock the church commissioners' money, I was astonished at two levels. First of all, because I spent 20 years on General Synod, and my the way I was educated about the resources of the Church of England were that the Queen Anne's bounty and the historic investments of the church commissioners were to be preserved as precisely as an investment in order that the church might live off the interest and do what it could with it. But what you couldn't do was dip into it in order to pay present bills, because down that way economic ruin would ultimately lie. And paradoxically, one of the reasons Justin Welby was identified as a potential leader in the Church of England was because he was understood to be familiar with the ways in which you could open and close taps institutionally. But I was quite offended when he began to set up a program of changing the legal duties of the church commissioners in order to allow an enormous sum of money to be taken out and to be used. Well, I suppose if he'd said it's going to be used to put new roofs on all the parish churches, one could say, well, perhaps the end justifies the means, maybe just. But to do it to pay reparations to the sixth generational descendants of slaves on the grounds that he was dealing in a concept of generational guilt, which isn't a Christian idea anyway. And if that wasn't bad enough, only then to be told by historians that, in fact, the investment resources of the Church of England were almost certainly disconnected at origin to profiteering from slavery. How is it possible that an otherwise group of sensible and well-informed middle-class people that Church of England comprises of can go down this route?
Yes, Gavin. So let me just tell your listeners, I guess you're alluding to, well, maybe you weren't, but I will state that the weekend before last, Policy Exchange published three papers under the title of A Case Against Reparations, subtitle, Why the Church Commissioners for England Must Think Again.
I was alluding to that, yes.
So just to make that clear to your listeners, and one of the papers is mine. So first of all, let me say, in what follows, I have no personal animus against Justin Welby. When I first got into public trouble over my supremely moderate views on colonialism some years ago, Justin took the trouble to write me a handwritten letter of consolation, which was very pastorally good of him. So this is not personal, but as I understand it, what seems to have happened is that Justin is convinced that the Church of England is institutionally racist, is convinced that British colonialism can be summed up in the word slavery and race, or the words slavery and racism, and he, I think, and Stephen Cotterill, the Archbishop of York, persuaded the church commissioners down a route that involved, in effect, delegating the issue to a body of folk. I don't know who chose them, but they described, several of the members are described as being activists. They say they sport two leading experts, neither of whom, in fact, were experts on the history of slavery, and neither of whom were ethical experts. And also, the body describes itself as being diverse in skill and background, but it is quite clear there is absolutely no diversity of thought, which is why...
No conservatives.
Which is why the body didn't even feel the need to publish a theological and ethical and historical justification for the report they did publish, which was simply recommending a set of practical implementations for the spending of £100 million in the first instance. And so our report, it does several things. I mean, on the one hand, my piece is simply saying that the case for reparations ethically, historically, makes no sense. That raises the question then, why has the Church of England been decided? And that leads to the question of process. And what this process appears to have lacked is any involvement of internal critical testing. And it's been pointed out that I think the Church Commissioners are trustees, and therefore they are subject to the guidance of the Charity Commission. And one thing that all trustees are enjoined to do by the Charity Commission in its guidance is, of course, when developing a policy, to include and consult different points of view so that a policy is properly tested. They didn't do that at all. And so I think the process amounts to a scandalous failure of due diligence. So it's a real mess, and I think the Church has embarrassed itself. Any attempt on the part of the likes of us to get the Church to slow down or think again, and we're treated as troublemakers. We're treated as racists. That's not been said, but it's kind of implied. And then Charles Wide got a letter from the Bishop of Leicester, an email, and I quote this because it wasn't obviously confidential, in which the complaint is that our agitation is demoralising black and ethnic minority ordinands in the Diocese of Leicester.
Good gracious.
And that's why we should stop doing it, because it's demoralising. And to which the answer is, to response is, well, there's no connection between our criticism of, there should be no connection between our criticism of this policy of reparations on grounds of historical fact and grounds of ethics and grounds of procedure, and the morale of black ordinands, unless non-white ordinands are seeking ordination on the basis of a set of false premises.
I was going to say, but the immediate riposte is, in that case, you've got the wrong kind of ordinand in the Diocese of Leicester. Well, and you need to change your ordinands, not to change the analysis of the situation by some historical experts.
But I fear, Gavin, that the Church will behave in no way different from the Post Office. They have to say, some people are zealots in the committee, and they will not listen. They will not listen. So, you know, even you can tell me if I'm exaggerating my self-perception, but I am a Christian ethicist. I've written on colonialism. I've written on slavery reparations. Did my church include me in this discussion? No. Why? certainly because I don't hold the right kind of opinion. Possibly because I've got the wrong skin color. The process has been appalling, and I'd love it if those responsible in the church were brave enough to have a kind of honest conversation or discussion about it, or brave enough to admit they've made a mistake, but I fear they won't.
No, well, this isn't the first ethical area in which there are contrary views that aren't welcome. I mean, the whole arena of sexuality, powerfully contested as it is, suffers from a similar problem, that if you don't go along with the majority, you are thought, as the left always do think, that you're evil rather than your views are wrong. And so, I mean, that's partly why I began with the notion of exploring what racism might be, and the fact that the whole movement you've been confronting is in fact a form of anti-white racism. Because it seems to me that unless we find ourselves with an even playing field in terms of our understanding of our moral strengths and weaknesses, we can't begin to have a proper conversation, because the progressives think that there's no point in having a conversation with people as evil as us. and that we're not sufficiently dignified morally to be capable of having a conversation with them. And so until we can establish a solid platform on which we can persuade them that our views aren't a sign of moral turpitude, it's very difficult to think that there might even be a conversation. But I have to think that if we've got to the point where somebody, I'm not flattering you, I mean, you described yourself very well. If one of the country's most best informed ethicists and historians is not welcome as part of the process of establishing the moral virtue of a position, then there's something problematically dogmatic and doctrinaire, and in this case, political rather than theological, about the process. But do you have any hope at all that Politico's paper will influence anybody? I mean, when I read it, I thought, hooray, some common sense and a seriously professional analysis of a very silly mistake. Surely this will turn the tide.
So just before I answer that, Gavin, I want to make clear to your listeners that the policy Exchange report has three essays, two by white men, one by a non-white woman, and it is prefaced by Tony Sewell, the black Jamaican Briton, who I guess himself is the descendants of slaves. So the Policy Exchange report is not just old white men. Even non-white Anglicans are distressed at what the church is doing. And then as for impact, well, you know, we were a bit disappointed at the lack of press attention. There was an article in the Sunday Telegraph last week, I think. And as I say, I fear the reaction of the church will be just to say nothing. On the other hand, this document is available online. Anyone can pick it up and read it. I don't know, but it's been reported to me that there is widespread unhappiness at the parish level. Even if it isn't true that parish contributions are contributing to the 100 million, and it's been denied that that is happening. Although I'm not sure anyone has asserted that, because the issue is whether any of the church community's resources should be spent in this way. And even if parish contributions aren't themselves feeding reparations, money that the commissioners should be using for the sake of parishes is being diverted. That's the issue.
Obviously. Yes, obviously.
So I guess the hope is that that maybe parish, maybe what we've written will give beleaguered, those who are holding up our parishes and feel beleaguered and ignored by the ecclesiastical elite, it will give them courage and ammunition. And I mean, is it possible for people in General Synod to start agitating? I mean, my impression of General Synod is it tends to be rather supine in front of these matters, partly because everyone is so scared of being accused of being racist, and there are people up front, I'm afraid, in the church who will do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do that. And they need to be faced down, because this is actually creating racial resentment. It's not a way of healing at all. I in an ideal world, our report would be treated with respect by the powers that be. We'd be invited in to have high level discussions. But I'm afraid, I think that too many reputations are now invested in this ill-judged project. That's not going to happen unless there's an extraordinary upsurge of courage in high quarters. So I think it's going to have to be a matter of growing agitation from the bottom, from the parish.
Well, Nigel, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. It's been a really wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot, and as always, I've learned so much from it. So thank you for everything you've contributed to common sense and to the face of the church and to a sort of clearer understanding of what we're dealing with. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and wonderful to meet you virtually. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yes, thanks, Gavin. And folks, we fight on. I mean, there are things, not least in the church, that are well worth fighting for. And although it looks sometimes a forlorn struggle. We're not allowed to give up, so we fight on, and we try and be reasonable. We try and keep our temper. We try and be charitable, and hope that the spirit will move.
Well, it's a great privilege to be standing side by side with you on this. So thank you for everything you've done. Bless you.